And welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore with a quick reminder that Michigan's standout musician Joshua Davis, whose stock rose significantly thanks to his performances on NBC TV's The Voice recently, joins us Friday to perform here on a Current State Live Music Friday. Later this hour, East Lansing has more in common with King's Landing than you might think. This is interesting. We'll talk with Chris Beasley of the company Valyrian Steel. That's the licensed official vendor of Game of Thrones replica weaponry and armor, and East Lansing Company. What a trip it's been for Chris after HBO created the series, you can imagine. Also, MSU professor Paul B. Thompson, author of From Field to Fork, joins us. He addresses the ethics of food in his book, and we will explore that as well. At the top of our program, we're going back to a conversation we had recently involving Lansing's Board of Water and Light. You might be aware that Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero has said the time has come to explore the possibility of selling the city-owned BWL. According to a statement provided to Lansing City Pulse, Bernero views potential changes involving the BWL as a way to address our long-term liabilities. However, he said any decision at this point would be premature. Bernero's been preoccupied with the long-term fiscal health of the city for years. Lansing's long-term budget deficit, estimated at $600 million, is comprised mainly of costly pension and health benefit obligations. He's expressed concerns about potential bankruptcy. The mayor has tapped our next guest to begin studying just such a move. Ex-Mayor David Hollister chairs the city's financial health team. We welcome Mayor Hollister back to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
You were hoping to meet with Mayor Bernero. Did you have a sit-down with the mayor yesterday? And if so, what transpired?
Yes, we had a very productive meeting. We set the framework for convening a meeting with the leadership of the fiscal health team and formulating a plan of action and a process and a public announcement. And I just wanted to make sure we were all on the same page because,
sure.
As you know, at one point, we had recommended, we've been working on this now on the fiscal health of the city for probably 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we had originally recommended to the mayor that he put this on the table, that everything be on the table. And he unequivocally said, no, absolutely not. In the state of the city, he made it clear that he was not prepared to do that. So there was some, you know, angst that, you know, he was limiting our scope. But he's the mayor, and it's his commission, and so we honored that. But at a recent meeting with Kevin Orr, I was in the meeting with the mayor, where Kevin Orr is the
emergency manager in Detroit.
Yeah, and he made it clear that a federal judge, a federal bankruptcy judge, trumps your city charter. And while you might think that this jewel, this Board of Water and Light, which we consider to be the crown jewel, this wonderful asset, is exempt from the bankruptcy process because the charter makes it a special and unique entity, you're dead wrong. That and everything's on the table.
And that comment of Kevin Orr's really got the mayor's attention?
It got his attention.
And your attention?
Well, I've been there. So I've been following it pretty closely, but mm-hmm. it clearly got the mayor's attention. And within a couple of days, he was announcing that he was open to the discussion. And it's not that we will go into this assuming that we should or should not sell. It's let's assess the value. Let's see what's happened in other communities that have taken municipally owned utilities and privatized them. Let's see what the market is. You know, when I was mayor, you know, 15 years ago, we looked at this quietly. It was not a public discussion, but we were approached by some investors out of the state. And at that time, the value that we were looking at was about $300 million. That's been 15 years. There's been a lot of changes, federal regulations. We've got capital improvements that must be made. We're going to be closing a couple of major facilities in the next 18 months. That we need to monetize. What is the value?
Mm-hmm.
And let's put a number on it.
And assess the market.
And assess the market.
Assess demand.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the council members quoted in the paper this week that She wasn't aware that there was a problem and that this should even be discussed, that the legacy cost issue had never really been convincing to her. And I think we need to have that open discussion. And here's the problem. And we can document it. Eric Cerconi's done a lot of study on the legacy cost. And it's not just Lansing that's facing these health care and retiree health care costs. Mark, you've got 2-to-1 retirees to current workers. So you got about 700 current city employees, 1,400 retirees.
Mm-hmm.
The retirees are living longer and spending more on health care.
Sure.
The number of city employees continues to go down, and many of them are having their benefits taken away. So the long-term liability is out there, and it's growing, and it's challenging most communities.
Will the FHT be making a recommendation to either sell or not to sell? Is that at the end of this process, will the financial health team either say, yeah, try to sell it, or no, don't try to sell it?
Premature to say. I don't know what we're going to find. That's one of the options.
Okay.
But I think we will probably make a recommendation, or we'll make a recommendation that we hire a consultant who specializes in this. We should take it to the next step. That, we've only got so much expertise. We're not experts ourselves.
You have referred to a deeper dive, a
right.
more technical
right.
Assessment
yes.
after your work
yes.
is done.
And it might be that's what we recommend to the mayor.
Well, the city's structural deficit is at about $600 million.
Right.
If you were to learn that consumers were willing to pay $700 million or $1 billion, how much more do you look at? I mean, in theory, that wipes out, in broad numbers, that wipes out the structural deficit. That sounds tempting to me to be able to do that. What else do you take into consideration?
Other potential competitors, interests that purchase utilities that are outside of Michigan.
BWL customers?
Possibly.
I mean, they pay, as far as I understand, they pay somewhat less for services than customers of consumers or DTE.
Yeah, and, when I was mayor, it was about 30%. That it was
less.
Cheaper.
Okay.
That the borderline line averaged 20% cheaper, which was really a major asset when we were negotiating with General Motors. That number is down closer to 5% now. So the gap has narrowed for lots of reasons. So it might not be a good investment, or it might be a great deal. I mean, mm-hmm. we can't go into this with a preconceived notion. We have to go into this open mind, fresh eyes, depoliticize it, and that's one of the things we want to do is have the council participate in this study with us so that this isn't a political football coming into the process, that the fiscal health team are business and community leaders. Half of them or more live outside the city, so they're going to bring a regional perspective. So you've got to look at this not just how it's going to impact Lansing and paying off Lansing's legacy costs, but what's the impact on Delta Township? What's the impact on East Lansing, Meridian Township, and our friends in the region? So hopefully one of the things we'll be announcing when the mayor goes public with this will be that we'll have regional players involved as well. So it's not just going to be Lansing residents looking at this from a Lansing perspective. It's going to be the fiscal health team looking at it in totality.
David Hollister, the chairman of the City of Lansing's financial health team, is our guest here on Current State. We're talking about his team's impending study of a sale of the Lansing Board of Water and Light.
Potential sale.
This is very interesting because it seems to me you have to take, you've acknowledged, you have to take into consideration the market, the likely demand on the free market for
right.
the utility. On the other hand, there are some number of people who philosophically oppose the sale of a public asset, of a jewel, as
right,
you referred
absolutely.
To it. Ken Fletcher of Delta Township at first told the City Pulse, privatizing a public asset should never be looked at. He kind of walked back away from that afterwards. What do you make of that anti-privatization mindset? It says this belongs to the city. No way we should sell it.
I think that's a very strong undercurrent in our community. I think we have, if the recommendation is to go forward, you're going to have to make a strong case for it. The Board of Water and Light has a long history of service and of excellence, and they had a blip a couple of years ago with an ice storm that caused some angst and consternation. But they have an enormous reservoir of goodwill, and the burden would be on the advocates for change to make a convincing argument that it's time to reconsider how it's structured. But I don't go into this with any preconceived notion that you should or shouldn't, although the bias will be, as a community, this is an asset we probably ought to keep, and you better make a darn good case, economic case and a philosophical case, because you've got to remember, this isn't just your homeowner. This is General Motors that purchases a great deal of this. And you've got a great economic boom going on in this region, and the Board of Water and Light is a major provider to them. And so how the sale would impact those deals that are in the process and, there's a lot of things you have to look at. Mm-hmm. So it's just not, we got a jewel here. It's worth $1 billion or whatever the number is, 700 million or 500 million. If it's 350, I'm not sure it's worth the fight. Mm-hmm. If it's $1 billion plus, it might be worth the argument. But then you're going to have to convince people how you're going to use this money. How are we going to be assured you're going to pay off these legacy costs and not go out and spend it on a new golf course?
Politically, what is required here, though? Does the city charter need would the city charter need to be changed? It seems like it.
I would imagine
probably
that,
would.
That we haven't looked at this. We have to look at
right.
What the requirements are. But I would imagine it would require a vote of the people to authorize the city to go forward.
You're not just the head of the financial health team, though. You're in an interesting position because, as mayor, you rode herd on the BWL for years. Does it surprise you that the discussion is turning to this possibility?
No, I guess nothing surprises me anymore. I've been around too long.
If you were still mayor, do you think you would be looking at this too?
Yes, I think I would. I don't know. I'd do it publicly, but I would. You have to reassess. I mean, every couple of years, you got to take fresh eyes and look at it. So I'm not uptight about it, but I want to depoliticize it. This needs to be a thoughtful, deliberative, transparent, regional evaluation from a solid business point of view and also a realistic political point of view. So we want all the players to be at the table and to go forward in a thoughtful and deliberative way and then make a recommendation. The mayor could reject it.
But clarify here. You do or you don't expect to make some kind of recommendation at the end of the process?
I would hope we would.
You're hoping to. That hasn't necessarily been determined, though.
Nothing's been determined.
Okay. Already, city council members are weighing in on this, both for and against. Will you'll try to tune all of that out during your work?
No, absolutely not. We want to hear from the council members. Okay. In fact, we will hopefully be engaging them in the process.
If you were to recommend not selling, it's speculative, I understand, but if you were to recommend not selling, is it possible Mayor Bernero could disagree and pursue a sale anyway?
Absolutely.
Remind us.
We're just an advisory committee. I mean, I give the mayor credit. He took a lot of courage to ask us to step up and take on this issue of the fiscal responsibility of the city. We've changed the way the council does business. We've done training with the council. They've gone through a 2-year budget process, and a lot of changes. It's been very constructive.
Did any kind of timeline emerge yesterday? Then I know next week the mayor is expected to say more.
Very soon. We didn't get a date nailed down because we got to put a committee meeting together of the leadership. But within the next week to 10 days, I would assume we'll have a public announcement. It'll spell out the process, the participants, the charge to the committee, and kind of the framework how we'll move forward.
A date by which you would probably have your work done? Do you
hopefully,
expect that
you know,
to come out of that? Okay.
We would hope to. But again, getting back to the council participation, they participate in the physical health team now.
Okay. We got to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. We want to thank David Hollister, chairman of the City of Lansing's financial health team. We've been talking about his team's impending study of a potential sale of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The subjects of food and ethics have merged in a new book written by Paul Thompson, the W.K. Kellogg Chair in Agricultural, Food, and Community Ethics here at Michigan State University. Its chapters touch on ethical questions related to meat production, environmental impacts, and even diet and obesity. He'll discuss his work tonight at the Schuller Bookstore in the Meridian Mall in Okemos. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Paul Thompson about the questions he hopes people will begin to ask themselves at the dinner table and at the grocery store.
Paul Thompson is the author of From Field to Fork. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Scott.
Your book is called From Field to Fork, Food Ethics for Everyone. So I want to begin by asking you what the major ethical issues are that you're addressing in this book.
Well, one of the things I did in this book was to try to focus on actually some of the less obvious ethical issues. I think when many people think of food ethics, they think about what it is that they ought to be eating. They think about that in very personal terms. And one of the things I did in this book was to really try to focus on a set of issues that are important no matter what you're eating, even whether you some vegetarians, for example, don't eat animals for ethical reasons, but there are reasons to be concerned about the way animals are treated, whether you're going to eat them or not. And so that's really been the focus. And then the other thing I was really trying to accomplish in the book was to make some connections between seemingly very diverse issues, how we treat animals on the one hand to questions about diet and obesity and hunger in developing countries on the other.
Do you take a position on these issues, or do you just raise ideas that we should all ponder?
I would say the main thing I'm doing is raising the ideas, but I don't shy away from taking a position in places where I feel like it's important or where I feel like the current state of the debate is neglecting important things.
I also want to find out if you address these issues not just on the individual level, but also maybe on the corporate level.
Well, certainly many of the topics that I talk about are places where the shape of our food system, the way that for-profit actors operate, whether they're small farms, large farms, food industry firms, companies that supply farmers, global trading companies, all of those come into the picture. On the other hand, I don't generally try to tell anybody what they ought to do. What I'm trying to do is to set a context for, I would call it, more productive discussion of all these issues.
We do want to encourage farmers and agribusiness to act ethically, though.
Of course, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We're talking with Paul Thompson, the W.K. Kellogg Chair in Agricultural, Food, and Community Ethics at MSU. He'll discuss his new book, From Field to Fork, on Monday night at 7 at the Schuller Bookstore in the Meridian Mall. Now, you've brought up vegetarianism, and I wanted to raise with you at greater length maybe the topic of eating meat. I'm not expecting you to come down on one side or the other on the eating meat issue maybe, but just what are the questions we should be answering for ourselves when it comes to consuming meat?
Well, the question of whether it's ethical to eat animals is actually a very old question. It was debated at some length by the ancient Greeks. And I think that in various religious traditions, part of the tradition of giving thanks before a meal or asking for a religious blessing is associated with a recognition that being able to eat is in some respects a gift, but also something that imposes costs on others, on nature, on God's creation in the tradition, in the Christian tradition. So there are, I think, straightforward ethical issues there. In the modern era, I think that some of those issues have become more complicated. They've taken a different shape. because of the way that we raise animals in these very large production systems. And so there are ethical questions that come up that are very specific to the way in which animals are raised, really irregardless of whether we plan to eat them or not.
I want to ask you about food security, because you've brought that up as an ethical issue. What do you mean by referring to food security as an issue of ethics?
Well, food security is a term that basically means do people have secure access to food? Can they eat today and can they anticipate being able to eat tomorrow? In the United States and in most industrialized countries, food security is largely a matter of having a secure income, because most of us buy our food, and we would be food secure to the extent that we know we're going to have enough to go to the store and buy it tomorrow. In the broader part of the world, it gets to be a more complicated story, because in fact, the vast majority of poor people in the world actually produce a significant amount of the food that they eat. So food security for a poor farmer in Africa or Latin America or Asia may actually have much more to do with being able to sell some of what they grow so that they'll be able to afford the other things that they need, and also so that they can fill in their diet in times when they run short.
And weather plays into that. Food security could destroy your crop and suddenly you and your family are hungry.
Weather's a big thing. Increasingly, it's other human beings that come in and destroy your crop. So warfare and instability in these countries is actually a major threat to food security as well.
And we hear about food deserts, where availability is based on whether you can get to a store or not.
That's right. Certainly one of the big issues in recent times has been this idea that in many urban areas, and to some extent this is true even in some neighborhoods in Lansing, it's difficult to get to a store. And as a result, people wind up shopping in little convenience stores, party stores, sometimes even liquor stores would be the main place where they would be getting access to the food that they'd be eating at home. Getting to a grocery store may require a bus ride, and it may be something that's very difficult for people to work into their day.
And you may have to handle multiple bags, maybe make multiple trips to handle the amount of food you need to buy.
Well, you know, when you think of carrying groceries back on the bus and how much you can handle, it might take multiple trips, and that adds up in terms of dollars as well.
If it takes you multiple trips to get from your car to the fridge, it takes someone in that position multiple trips to get from the store home.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Paul Thompson is the author of From Field to Fork. He'll talk about the book at the Schuller Bookstore in Okemos tonight. I want to ask you how you think we should think about genetically modified foods. There have been efforts to require the labeling of GMOs, for instance, and they've been resisted by some food producers. What are the ethical issues around GMOs in your mind?
Well, the GMO issue is, in some respects, an issue that really cuts across a lot of problems in food ethics. You know, the labeling issue is, I think, a good entry point. This is an issue on which I've taken a position, and I've had a position for many years. I think that there are good ethical reasons why people might want GMOs labeled. They really fall into the same kind of group that people want labels related to fair trade, or they want labels related to their ability to practice a religiously sanctioned diet. You know, kosher and halal labeling comes to mind. There are any number of reasons why somebody might prefer to eat foods that are traditional and that haven't been produced in a particular way. So I've long supported the idea that we should have labels. On the other hand, mandatory labeling is problematic for two reasons. One reason is that currently the only mandatory labels in the United States are related to some sort of food safety risk. We have labeling with respect to a very small number of products that are allowed on the market, some artificial sweeteners. Alcohol is a case in point. But the Food and Drug Administration actually does not permit labeling that would imply a health benefit unless there's scientific evidence for that. And in the case of GMOs, there isn't any such evidence. The second reason is that requiring a label is a form of compulsory speech. It's requiring you to say something about your product, and compulsory speech has been regarded as something very close to restriction of speech in the U.S. tradition. So the idea of actually requiring somebody to say something about a product or an activity, unless there is a significant public interest at stake, actually runs against our ethical traditions as well.
How is the pricing of food an ethical issue?
Well, pricing is an ethical issue in very contradictory ways. On the one hand, when prices go down, people have money to spend on other things. And that traditionally is thought of as an ethically good thing. It means we can enjoy broader and more different kinds of consumption. On the other hand, when food prices go down, it makes things very difficult for farmers. And having a stable farm economy has been a big problem everywhere, including in the United States, for hundreds of years. Farmers really struggle with the volatility in prices. And I would actually say that when we think on a global basis, it might be a good thing for our food prices to be a little higher than they currently are.
Paul Thompson is the W.K. Kellogg Chair in Agricultural, Food, and Community Ethics at MSU. He'll discuss his new book, From Field to Fork, Food Ethics for Everyone, at 7 o'clock on Monday at the Schuler Bookstore in the Meridian Mall. Paul Thompson, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, a partnership between a Michigan State University startup company and a Michigan-based medical sector investment firm is beginning a new treatment for infant jaundice closer to market. And plus, we'll hear about a company that's bringing a little bit of Westeros to East Lansing. Current State's April Van Buren talks to the owner of Valyrian Steel, the officially licensed merchandiser for the HBO series Game of Thrones. That and more coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You can contact us via email, currentstate@wkar.org, and you can reach me directly, Mark Bayshore, at 517-884-4776. We're always eager to hear what's on your mind and what you make of the program and how you think we might make it better. A new medical device invented by three MSU undergraduate students is getting closer to market. Current State's Melissa Benmark has that story. What's this about, Melissa?
This is very cool. The device is called a Snuglet, and it's a much more streamlined and less clunky form of technology that's been used traditionally to treat babies with jaundice. There's a therapy called blue light therapy that helps them. Engineering students Oliver Bloom, Vu Huang, and Alexa Jones created it a while back. It won a bunch of design competitions, and now a startup company is trying to get it to market. The company is called TheraBee, and its CEO is Ryan Jankovic, who has a number of years of experience in the medical device business and has been mentoring the students. When I spoke with him recently, I asked him to first tell me about the birth of the Snuglet.
Yeah, well, it's a really cool story because, again, as being undergraduates and being 22 years old, you know, you're thinking about am I going to graduate and where am I going to find my first job and get a real paycheck, you know? So a lot of credit and really all the credit goes to be able to take the project that was given. And the project was really taking a look at third world countries and finding out a better solution, you know, that goes with jaundiced babies. If you take a look at the third world countries, you might have a billy bed. You might see 5 to 7 babies all kind of crammed together to really take advantage of the blue light spectrum, if there is even one in the local area where children are born. So that's where their project started. They're clearly not going to third world countries being undergrad students, but, you know, just interviewing around the area and talking to healthcare professionals, what they uncovered is that here in the United States, treatment isn't perfect either. And between and the more mobile billy blankets that are on the market today, there's a number of areas that are in need of improvement, and with the blessing of the professor, they pivoted and they made their project more based on solving domestic needs, and went out and interviewed, and they really found themselves to be more entrepreneurial than they had ever expected to be, and that's really how the whole project started.
So when you're talking about billy blankets, you're talking about something that reduces the level of bilirubin.
You know, we all have bilirubin levels in our body, but to be able to break those down effectively, and, you know, that's what the light ends up doing. So if you think of a bed, I think a lot of people incorrectly call them incubators. You know, you see a baby born and they're put into the incubator, and certainly incubators have their use and function, but the purpose of this with a jaundice baby is really a lighting bed, and that's what I refer to as a billy bed.
So one of the things that's really cool about this blanket technology is that it allows the parents to actually hold their babies while they're in treatment for jaundice.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so my oldest son was he wasn't born with jaundice, but on his official day one, he was diagnosed with high levels of bilirubin, otherwise healthy, discharged for home, and so we were at home for 5 days with a billy blanket. We didn't experience the bed treatment, but we did experience the blanket. And this is obviously years before I became, you know, associated with this product line, and never had thought that, boy, there's probably a better solution, but did experience frustration with the pad slipping down. It was attached to a big console that had to be plugged into work. You know, so when people are coming over, you know, having a baby being born is one of the more joyful times to ever visit a hospital. It's maybe the only joyful time to visit a hospital. And really what our goal is functionality. You know, it's a bad example, but what the cell phone industry has done with smartphones is really taken, a phone that had one function and made it really very functional. And that's what we want to do in this regard, on obviously a much different example. But, you know, treatment that babies need, how can you do the other functions? How can you diaper change effectively? How can you breastfeed effectively? How can you, you know, show off your baby without eye covers and other protective items that are needed today? Because the device really wasn't designed for all of the activities in an infant's day. It was designed to give the treatment to really start to break down those bilirubin levels, which we can do that, but we also want to provide a better solution to our patients and the little guys and girls in the first few days of life.
So that's interesting that you had some experience with that yourself, and then I suppose, you know, this hearing about this project must have gotten your attention.
Yeah, well, you know, this is my company does medical device startup, really before I focused most of my attention to therapy. And so doing medical device startups, I was reached out and said, hey, do you know what these students are doing here in town? Do you think you can help them as they go to competitions? And absolutely. And I do this probably on a weekly basis, kind of give or take, depending on where the opportunities are, but give guidance, connections, help startup companies. You know, I think specifically for the state of Michigan, the more of us, and there's plenty of us that help and want to see these startups succeed, the better it is for the state, and the better it is for the suppliers, the manufacturers, the people that do quality and regulatory, and ultimately the better it is for the OEM, because you've got all these startup companies with really good niche ideas, and these larger OEMs with their big distribution networks and dollars, they can really really grow these ideas. That's the hope here, is one of these bigger companies, these bigger device manufacturers will someday see what we're doing with treating infant jaundice and be able to say, boy, we can really take this good idea and expand this on a global level.
One of the things that crosses my mind is that things like incubators or that billy blanket you were talking about, you know, could be out of the cost range of a lot of people in hospitals. Is this new device an improvement on that in any way?
Yeah, we don't have final cost figures anyway, Mark. I mean, that's one of the things that we're working on. In today's age, cost is more important and vital than it ever has been in years past. We know that in addition to being, you know, cost competitive, we really have to be a solution to hospitals. Now, there is reimbursement that comes from insurance because this is a treatment. So it's understanding that reimbursement. We recognize that this product is more of a want to have rather than a need to have, right? And there's treatment that every hospital across the country has today. And so what really our opinion is going to be is, hey, we've got better treatment. So when you're looking to replace, you know, look to us, or, you know, as you are looking at therapies, if you do have, you know, depending on our cost situation, because we are more cost effective to you than the competitor, we want to make this an easier buying decision for you.
So are these on the market now or soon to be?
They're not. Soon is obviously a relative term because this does require a 510K approval from the FDA. And so that is the wild card, is that we don't market, we don't sell, we don't do anything. Right now we're in research phase and kind of putting the binder together to be able to submit to the FDA. And with the FDA's, clearance on that, then we are able to really market the product. So really at this point, you can say this is very much under development. This is very much in the idea and concept phase, but we're putting all the pieces together to really have a successful submission sometime within the next few months, but it's probably a little bit longer than that.
So the original three engineering students who came up with the design, what's their role in this now? Have they moved on and they're completely out of it, or do they still have some attachment to the outcome of this particular device?
Well, yeah, ironically, they see this as their, quote unquote, their baby, right? So they are still very involved. Two of the three of them live out of state and work for very large, very recognizable, reputable companies that everyone would be impressed to be able to hear about. And then and Oliver is going on to for his master's degree in biomedical engineering at University of Michigan.
So they still got a hand in this whole process.
They would at any point in time. I just sent them an email this morning looking for some technical background with our contract manufacturer that we're working with, and there's no doubt maybe even by the time we hang up that there'll be some things in my email box. They live in three different time zones.
That's always so fun, isn't it?
Yeah, so they get different parts of their day, but as they find time, and they always do, they stay very much involved, which is great. It's great to see.
Ryan Jankovic, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Melissa, it was a pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State every weekday, three times a day, 9 and 6 on 90.5 FM, every day at noon on AM 870 WKAR. I beg your pardon. Last Sunday, Game of Thrones fans said goodbye to the dragons and the White Walkers and the epic battle scenes of their favorite show, at least until next spring. But if you can't wait until season 6, you can get your own piece of the Seven Kingdoms, and you don't even have to go all the way to Westeros. Current State's April Van Buren is here to tell us more. How far do we have to go?
Not very far at all, Mark, because the officially licensed merchandiser for the HBO series, as well as the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin, is right here in East Lansing. It's a company called Valyrian Steel, and I talked to owner Chris Beasley about what it's like to make merchandise for one of the world's most popular TV shows. And before we get to the interview, I will mention that there are some spoilers ahead for the season 5 finale, so if that's still in your DVR queue, you've been warned. I met up with Chris at his office, which is decorated with the swords and pieces of armor that they make from Game of Thrones. And these definitely aren't the kind of props that you'd use for a Halloween costume. They're made of real metal, and some are pretty lethal looking.
Yeah, they would certainly hurt someone. I tell people with the Warhammer, which is the most dangerous thing we sell, you could kill someone in an accident with it. It's a 10-pound sledgehammer with spikes on it. I mean, you would go through a car door. They're certainly not toys.
And so you first approached George R.R. Martin when you were just 25. And so when you approached George R.R. Martin, this is obviously before the HBO series, what was your pitch to him? How did you convince him that you were the one to do this work?
Well, I had had a lot of success retailing Lord of the Rings swords, and I talked up my success about them. And I was just very straightforward with him and offered him what was at the time for him, I think, a rather large, sizable advance. And I was told by his agent that he liked my Midwestern straightforwardness. He is originally from New Jersey, but he went to school in Chicago, and then he taught, I believe, in Iowa. Obviously, he took a chance on us because it was, you know, we'd never made anything before, but it's worked out with him.
For those first pieces of merchandise, obviously the HBO show wasn't out yet, so you weren't working off a physical thing. You were kind of going off the descriptions from A Song of Fire and Ice. What was the design process like when you were working from the books?
Oh, well, first I'll correct you. It's A Song of Ice and Fire. All the nerds out there listening.
I stand corrected.
If I don't correct you on that. So we work with George kind of like a police sketch artist would work with a witness. Our artist will draw 8 maybe different swords and send them to George. And George will say, well, I'd like the hilt on that one and the pommel here and the blade shape over here and change that. And that's not good at all. And then we slowly winnow it down to a sword design that he's happy with. And we go from there.
Obviously, when you started this, the HBO series hadn't come out yet. But how has that process changed now that there is obviously very elaborate sets and props that are coming from the HBO show? How do you guys design those things now? Is that in collaboration with the show?
No, it's not. And it's really, there's 2 major changes that happen. When we work with HBO, they send us the props, which is really cool and fun for us because we get to play with the actual screen use props. And with this, it's just a straight up copy job. We take pictures, we take measurements, we take molds where necessary, and then we just copy it. We don't have to worry about designing. And it's actually a lot faster process. And the other thing that's changed is we still do work with George. And we still do designs with him independent of the show. It's just his world has exploded to such a degree that it takes him a long, 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 long time to do product approvals with us anymore because he's got so many things on his plate. And, you know, whereas used to, I would send him an email or a message and I would get a response back usually in a day or two. It can be a lot, lot longer now.
You started out doing this merchandise for the books. You maybe had this inkling that it could go somewhere else, but what was it like to see the show take off the way it has? It's really one of the most popular TV shows out there right now and has become sort of this pop culture sensation. What was that like for you as a fan of the books and as someone who's been working on designing this merchandise from the start? What was that like for you to see that?
It honestly wasn't very surprising. Once it was going to be a thing that the HBO was going to do the show, I never had a doubt in my mind that it was going to be as popular as it is. The books, people will be reading the books in 100 years. I firmly believe that. So the source material is so compelling. And with that source material and with HBO's pedigree of producing quality programming, I always knew it was going to be successful. I'm certainly pleased it's as successful as it is, but I was never worried that the show was going to get canceled or wasn't going to be a success. I knew in my heart from day one that once HBO pulled the trigger to do the show that it was going to be huge.
So what's been the most exciting part of working with HBO on this? Have you gotten to interact with any of the writers or the actors or the set designers?
A little bit. Not really. I would interact. There's, you know, we've spoken with some of the people who work on the show and, of course, some of the actors I've met. The most exciting thing probably is just being involved with it and also getting the handle the actual show props and stuff is always very exciting, knowing that, hey, look, Sean Bean held the sword and it was on screen and now it's in my hands. And working with George R. R. Martin is really cool. There's in Texas A&M University at their library, they have a George R. R. Martin collection and it's his official collection, his works. And the stuff that I've made, the products that I've made are in this collection in this library,
so cool.
Which is essentially a museum. And people go there and view this stuff in like a museum setting, like for academic research or whatever, because he's become such an influential author. And I'm now a part of that, part of his history. So that's really cool too.
Both the show and the books have a lot of very rabid fans. They have a huge fan base, exploded in popularity. There's, you know, countless internet forums where people go and talk about this all day long. What kind of reaction have you gotten from those people who, you know, really love this series? And I think, you know, it's a very personal thing to them.
We have really great reviews. Everyone seems to like our products, and people tend to really like us. We're fans, so we're not just some company out there trying to cash in on this pop culture phenomenon. We're fans of it from way back. We care about it, and I think that shows through in the work. And, you know, always when fans ask us questions, they can't stump us. You know, if they ask us a trivia question about the books, and we can have arguments about it, but they're well-educated arguments about a character or a pedigree of a sword or something like that. And I think they appreciate that knowledge, and we're not just, you know, some no-name company that is just trying to take advantage of the popularity of the books.
Chris Beasley is the owner of Valyrian Steel, which is the official licensed merchandiser for the HBO show Game of Thrones and the George R.R. Martin series, A Song of Ice and Fire. I know that Valyrian Steel, as well as your family, is soon going to be picking up and moving to Tennessee, and you guys are building a pretty unique house there. Could you tell me a little bit about your new digs?
Well, yeah, I've as I said, I was a nerd going way back. I've always been interested in castles and knights and wizards and swords and everything like that. So it's been my dream for a long time to build a castle, and specifically to build a castle in the sort of scenery that you'd find in Europe, where you're usually mountainous, the foothills of the Alps or something like that. And, you know, that kind of geography exists down in Tennessee, and it's also pleasantly a lot warmer than Michigan. I'm born and bred here in Michigan and from northern Michigan, but the winter is not fun, and we do like more outdoor time, and I do like to garden, so I like a longer growing season. So it's been planned a long time that we'd move to Tennessee, and we're finally making that move this summer, and our warehouse is moving, employees are moving with us, I'm moving, of course, my wife, everything's set up and good to go, and down there we are, thankfully, being able to build a castle. And it's not really a big castle. It's more of a keep. If you're into medieval architecture, it'd be more defined as a keep than a full castle, because it's not big enough to be a castle, but you can call it a castle. And I'm trying to make it as historically accurate as possible while making it as energy efficient still as possible.
And I know that you have two young children, and I'm wondering, I mean, I remember growing up, my dad reading me Tolkien and reading me C.S. Lewis, and I'm wondering if you've started to pass along any of that passion to your two young kids.
I have. They're not quite there yet on those books. I think I might try to do some of that soon. They are certainly familiar. I make sure they're well up on their movies and everything. And I was really pleased one time. My son, who was at that time, I think, 4, told me that he thought Star Wars was way better than Lord of the Rings. And I was just so pleased that he had an opinion. So I'm certainly trying to raise them right. You know, both my kids know that Leia is Darth Vader's daughter, and, you know, that's important to know. They don't know anything about Game of Thrones yet. Quite a few years before they read that. But I certainly like to expose them to the things that I'm interested in.
And then the final question I want to ask you, obviously you guys are really busy here right now because the season 5 finale just aired on Sunday, and the big dramatic end to that was the death of Jon Snow. And I'm wondering, there's a lot of theories out there. I was wondering if you have any theories about the future of Jon Snow.
Yeah, I do, actually. First of all, I really don't think Jon Snow is dead. I don't get any secrets from George R. R. Martin. I would like to say, yes, he's told me secrets, but he doesn't. When George R. R. Martin, if you've read his books, and I have several times, when he kills someone, he kills them in the middle of a chapter, in the middle of a book. And by the next chapter, the person is having a funeral, and then their bones are being sent back to Winterfell. Every time he has put someone in mortal peril at the end of a chapter or the end of a book, as far as I can remember reading his books, that person has always survived. So in both the show and in the books, Jon's supposed death comes at the end of a book and the end of a chapter. And so I firmly believe that he's going to live. And most people, I think, also believe this. And they believe either that he's going to warg, which is transfer his mind spirit into his wolf named Ghost, or more likely, I think, is that Melisandre, the Red Woman, will raise him, because the show and the books have established that the Red Priests and Priestesses have that power to save people who are mortally wounded. And then my other prediction is that the wall's going to come down, because you don't build an 800-foot wall of ice unless you want to knock it over. And then my other prediction is, at the end, Jon's not going to matter. Everyone wants him to be king or marry Daenerys, and he's certainly a good character, but in the end, he will not be king, and the actual protagonist of the entire series is Jaime Lannister.
Wow, that's quite a prediction. Yep. I'm interested to see how that plays out. I've been talking to Chris Beasley. He's the owner of Valyrian Steel, which is the official licensed merchandiser for the HBO show Game of Thrones and for the George R.R. Martin series, Song of Ice and Fire. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. Tomorrow on Current State, with almost all of the summer in Michigan still in front of us, we visit with Michigan kayaker, author, Doc Fletcher. He's got a new book out about kayaking in Michigan and other places in the Midwest that also places that also have baseball parks. So two of his main passions, kayaking, paddling, and baseball all come together in Doc's latest book. We'll visit with Doc tomorrow. Plus, in the so-called golden age of radio, news broadcasts were usually something less than authentic. The most famous radio hoax in history wasn't the first fabricated news broadcast. Okemos native Brad Schwartz makes his case in his first book, Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, as the art and the art of fake news. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks as well to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, and to Drew Hill for engineering. The latest episodes of Current State can be sent straight to your pocket every weekday morning. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media, Twitter, at KAR Current State. On Facebook, just search Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us. We'll see you Tuesday on Current State on WKAR.